We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
You're listening to episode 233 of TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, the West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined as always by the one and only Mr. Daniel Feinberg, The Hollywood Reporter's chief TV critic. How's it going, Chief?
Oh, just celebrating the beginning of spooky season, you know, loading up on pumpkin spice everything, getting all my candy ready for Halloween, becoming diabetic, all of those things, apparently. But how about you, Leslie?
I'm getting ready to leave for Vegas, and I'm seeing you two at the Sphere this weekend, and I am so excited to do that. I cannot wait. The videos that I've seen from that venue just look astounding. Like, it's going to be so cool. I can't wait. Plus, I love you two, so...
Sounds like next week we're going to have a Leslie Reviews U2 in Las Vegas segment, because while Leslie is not technically a TV critic, there's no reason why Leslie can't be a live music critic.
Sure. I've written a couple of concert reviews in my time.
Excellent. Then perhaps you will tell us next week how U2 is and how Vegas was. I hope you also win lots of money at the tables.
I'll be shocked if I actually go do any gambling at all, because maybe I'll just go to the sports book and put some money on the Dodgers in the playoffs. So
I think you absolutely should do that. How about buffets?
I don't know, but I did make a reservation for our group at a steakhouse, so I'm very excited for that.
Okay, but to me, Vegas is blackjack and buffets. So
I mean, usually it's blackjack and buffets for me too, but this weekend is about food and great music and seeing some good friends.
I hope that it is a good time.
But on the TV front, well, SAG-AFTRA is still talking with the AMPTP as the performer strike continues. Meanwhile, writers' rooms are restarting across the broadcast and streaming spectrum with a goal of getting scripted back, at least on broadcast, by early next year. And as soon as January at NBC, this week we broke that Dick Wolf is expected to be among the first shows returning to broadcast with his Law and Order, Chicago, and FBI shows. Most of those are going to be probably among the first back because he's been doing this a long time and he knows exactly what he's doing and how to deliver these episodes in a timely and cost-effective fashion. And let's see, the rest, probably following that, you're going to probably have ABC's multi-camera comedies and other multi-cams across the broadcast. Those are likely in February, and then Fox and the CW probably later on in the spring. CW is probably going to be an April return for what little it has left. So, but that's the update on the strike front, which
and
I'm
all
very
of this
excited.
Is obviously presupposing that the SAG-AFTRA strike is also settled because
in a timely
course.
Fashion. Yeah, and you've got the same Fab Four executives who are in the negotiating room as part of the AMPTP and hearing all about the different demands of the actors and the performers unions. So look, when the four executives went into the negotiating room with the WGA, there was a deal. Let's see, they started so Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 5 days. There was a deal in 5 days. So, and AMPTP are not meeting every single day, but they've met this week. I believe it was Monday and Wednesday and Friday. They're going to continue talking over the weekend and regroup again on Monday. So yeah, I'm honestly expecting a deal sometime next week. But that's just based on what I'm hearing from studio people, and it could be wishful thinking. But yeah, that's what we know on that front.
Fab Four, you say? I am uncomfortable with any situation in which David Zaslav is described as Fab. But you know, you
okay.
Do you.
Okay, the key four executives that
big,
are in,
I
in
could
the
just go with how about Big Four? Big Four seems to work. I don't have a problem with that as an assessment, but Fab, gotta save Fab for people who are a little bit more fabulous, Leslie. Like you.
Aw, you're very nice, Dan. I appreciate you.
Number one.
Leading off, we're gonna get back to headlines in a little bit, but for now we're gonna do mailbag this week because, yeah, deal making is still slowly returning to normal with the writer's strike now behind us. And of course, that's probably going to be overwhelmingly ratified early next week. So yeah, let's see. First up, Eric writes, after reading the WGA's new minimum basic agreement, why are streamers so reticent to release any viewing numbers publicly, and what does that accomplish?
I think the answer is one of two things. And the primary reason is sort of Schrodinger's streaming ratings can be anything you want, whereas actual revealed streaming numbers are what they are. So the two reasons why you would not want to release your ratings, and I feel like there are basically only two, and you can correct me, is if they're ridiculously high, that's going to mean that the people involved are going to want more money. And if they're ridiculously low, that's going to tank your stock price and everything is going to collapse and the entire infrastructure of the new industry in which we exist is going to cave in on itself as we suddenly discover that there are shows on Peacock that are being watched by six people. So I think those are the two answers, is that if we find out that everything's being watched by 75 million people and that everything is a massive hit, then people are going to be like, okay, please pay me more. And if we find out that nothing is being watched by anybody and that nobody is completing any of these shows, then everybody needs to step back and go, is this a reasonable way to be distributing art? As long as you keep it in the dark, everything can be a hit, everything can be a failure, and no one can tell you you're wrong about any of it. Do you have an alternative to those two alternatives as the best reasons? Also, lack of standardization and the lack of cohesion in terms of what the standards are, because obviously streaming service X has 100 million subscribers and streaming service Y has 15 million subscribers. So you're going to have a show on streaming service Y that is watched by 17 people and a show on streaming service X that's watched by 20 million people. And is that a fair comparison? But on the other hand, we've been comparing ratings for USA and TNT dramas to ratings for IFC comedies for decades. And those
I was going to say NBC versus HBO, where sure, HBO you have to pay to actually see. So there's a limited number of people who have HBO versus NBC, which you can get for a $20 antenna.
Yeah. So that becomes an unfair comparison as well. Look, and the reasons why we on this podcast have over and 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 over again, once or twice, said that we would like ratings has never been so that we could distinguish between the audience of Stranger Things and the Continental. This is just me throwing out two sort of blockbustery type shows, but more just so that we could distinguish between what it looks like to be a success on Netflix versus what it looks like to be a failure on Netflix, and to kind of distinguish between what it says about the service and its audience if Stranger Things is a smash hit and Everything Sucks is a failure. What does it mean to be one on the same streamer and to be the other on the same streamer? It's never been to say Ted Lasso is a bigger hit than Killing It. I don't know why I keep mentioning Peacock shows, but I do. Yeah, so it's never been to necessarily make streamer by streamer, side by side comparisons in that respect. It's just been so that we understood what it looked like to be a success, a failure, and somewhere floating in the middle on all of these services, just because we can't give educated analysis if we don't know these things. You are a reporter, you need data, because that is the thing that you require to do your job. I don't require data quite so much, but I still like to know. So that's why we want these numbers. I feel like I definitely gave a few reasons why they wouldn't.
Think of it this way, and I'm not going to add anything that you really didn't touch on here, Dan, but if these numbers were as high as people think they are for a show like Stranger Things or even Ted Lasso, wouldn't you scream those from the rooftops if you had really, really excellent news to share? But if you're Netflix and you've got 200 million global subscribers, more than that, but 20 million are completing the new season of Stranger Things, how does that look? What are the optics there? Right? I mean, 20 million for a show is pretty great in this day and age, but when you've got an audience of 200 plus million, pales in comparison, right?
And that's the other thing also, is that the lack of a clear standardized metric allows people to kind of cherry pick and to give confusing information. So what we obviously always say is completion rate is clearly the most important thing, but you would have to train people in the public to understand what those things actually mean. Now, that, of course, That is your job. That is Rick Porter's job. That is Alex Weprin's job. That is the job of qualified and intelligent reporters slash analysts slash commentators. That's their job. But instead, we kind of end up with these various different piecemeal things. And even the WGA deal ends up only with a version of piecemeal data transparency. There's just no, it's hard to end up with the kind of across the board information that would allow people to actually be intelligent on these subjects. Just as a rule, we would prefer to be intelligent on these subjects. So our next question, or our second question this week, and I should add that for future weeks, you should, as always, email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That's tvstop5@thr.com. Our second question this week comes from Pedro, who writes, "My question is about streamers and maybe Netflix in particular. You've told us many times how streamers are always looking for library content consisting of easy to watch 100 plus episode shows, as this helps them avoid churn and increase engagement. See the recent success of Suits. The question is, if that's the case, why don't they try to develop this kind of show themselves instead of going for the latest shiny thing that'll be canceled after two short seasons? Why, instead of always looking for the new Game of Thrones, don't they look for a new NCIS or the new Criminal Minds?"
The answer is they are. We talked a few months ago about Netflix describing the fare that they were looking for as being gourmet cheeseburger. And that remains a favorite anecdote of mine. But what that effectively means is they want things that are easy to digest, that can reach a broad audience, but that still looks shiny enough. So I was talking to an exec this week, about what's hot in the marketplace as things return to development and things are getting greenlit, et cetera. And one of the things that I kept hearing over and over again was premium broadcast, which is basically a different way of saying a gourmet cheeseburger. So when you look at Netflix, because that's what this question asked, I mean, look at The Night Agent, right? I mean, that could be a show that airs on broadcast, maybe clean up some of the language and perhaps a little of the violence, but that's effectively a broadcast show. And it's made by someone who has roots deep in broadcast, in Sean Ryan, right? Like one of my favorite interviews that we've had on this show pre-strike. And you can go back and listen to Sean Ryan talk all about The Night Agent. That was in episode 207 from March 24th of this year. But when you look at what Netflix is greenlighting and some of the stuff that's working for them, it's broadcast fare that looks a little shiny. So maybe it's Kerry Russell in The Diplomat. I mean, that easily could have been a show that aired on broadcast. Right, Dan?
Oh, absolutely. The Diplomat is a slightly smarter, slightly sexier, slightly more polished version of Madam Secretary. And that is in no way an insult to The Diplomat, a show I really like. You mentioned Night Agent, totally a show that could have aired on broadcast. Lincoln Lawyer, completely and totally. And another
literally
show.
Literally was developed for CBS before they passed and picked it up on Netflix. And now it's a huge hit on Netflix.
Looking at other services, I feel as if Amazon has had a lot of its bigger successes with that kind of thing, whether it's Bosch and After Bosch or whatever the spinoff is.
Honestly, the shows that people keep bringing up, Jack Ryan, Reacher, these are shows that perform well, allegedly here domestically, and they travel well. Right. And then you look at something like Yellowstone, which not technically a streaming show, even though it has first run episodes on Paramount Network. But that's a show that everyone's going after, too, because it's similar to Succession. Right. It's a family drama with a big character at the center. And I'm talking about Yellowstone, not necessarily Succession, because that has many great characters at the center. And keep in mind, I've not seen Yellowstone. That's not a show that's really up my alley. But anyway, that's what people are looking for. They want these shows that have the big broad reach. And when you think of that, literally it's in the name of what it is, broadcast television, right? So what I will be curious of coming out of at least the writer strike is if Netflix will expand the number of episodes per season to try and build up that library. Because if they want to do, 10 seasons of The Night Agent with 50 episodes, that's great, but that's still not a library that it's a big library for them, because I think what are their longest running shows? It's Orange is the New Black on the drama side, and the one with Jane Fonda, Grace and Frankie.
Okay,
Grace and Frankie, right? Like
I was going to suggest it might be The Ranch, but
No, I mean, but that's a different model, right? They picked up 20 episodes and split them at 10 episodes and called them season 1A, season 1B, right? To save money. Either way, that's literally what a lot of these streaming services are doing, especially the ones that are looking for that big, broad audience. And that's honestly everyone right now. So Apple will still, you know, try and do all the premium, shiny, fancy stuff because, well, they're Apple and they've got money to burn. But everywhere else, it really does feel like they are looking for the next Yellowstone, for the big soapy family show, or the big comedy that can stack lots of episodes.
I mean, look at Paramount Plus as I would say the clearest example of trying to do that. I mean, not only do they have a bunch of shows that actually were broadcast shows, things like Evil, which came over and is now a Paramount Plus show, but they're obviously looking for the next Yellowstone, hence all of their Taylor Sheridan shows. They're obviously looking for the next major broadcast style comedy. Look at Frasier. So yeah, I mean, what Paramount Plus is doing is absolutely much more trying to be a broadcast adjacent streamer than trying to do anything prestige-y. And I suspect it's an entire, you know, again, all of the Star Trek shows. What is Star Trek? Star Trek is a show that has a deep and long history on broadcast. And what is the Star Trek show of their shows that people have the most affection for? The new one, Strange New Worlds, which is basically a week by week episode Star Trek procedural. There is definitely a push to do some more of that, whether it's at some point going to become the majority of what we see, you know, if there are a number of hits that are in that vein, people will follow.
Yeah, absolutely. And as Dan said, keep sending us your questions, whether we do mailbag every week or monthly from now on. We still need questions. So drop us an email at TV's Top 5 at the numeral 5 at THR.com.
Number 2.
Up next, it's October. Dan, usually this would be when broadcast gets into full swing because you've got, you know, the third week of September of premiere week, and you've probably have CW shows usually joining the fray. All that's out the window. So I'm going to run down some of the bigger high-profile shows launching this month, and we can go from there. So NBC has already launched Found, which was developed 2 years ago and held from last season to this season as a strike programming move. Chucky season 3, that's going to air across Peacock USA and Sci-Fi. Season 2 of Loki on Disney Plus has already launched. Our Flag Means Death is back for season 2 on HBO Max. You've got The Fall of the House of Usher coming on Netflix. Dan, you just mentioned Frasier on Paramount Plus. Showtime has The Curse. That's the one from the Safdie brothers starring Emma Stone. Goosebumps is back for more on Hulu. Apple TV has Lessons in Chemistry. Shining Vale is back for season 2 at Stars, which they're doing some interesting and weird stuff over there. Rick and Morty season 7 is back, with this time without Justin Roiland and two newcomers newcomers or relatively unknowns as the new voices of Rick and Morty. And Big Mouth season 7, that's one of your favorites, Dan. Upload season 3 on Amazon, that's one of my favorites. Fellow Travelers on Showtime, and then The Gilded Age season 2 on HBO. What stands out to you when you look at what's coming in October, Dan?
There are large patches that are without programming, and that is kind of what stands out for me. And yet there are a lot of big things. You mentioned The Curse. It's having its New York Film Festival premiere this month. I think it's actually a November premiere in terms of actual airing for Showtime. But it's another of those strange months where it's easy to look at a few of the things and go, well, of course, I know exactly why there is a new Mike Flanagan limited series, and that would be The Fall of House of Usher.
The way, you're right about The Curse. That is Friday, November 10th.
Yeah, so
that's on Showtime, I guess, maybe Showtime with Paramount Plus. I don't know. It's always a couple days early when you're on Showtime. You just got to figure it out.
Exactly. You definitely have to figure it out, and we'll talk about that in much more depth in November. But yeah, so, you know, some of the stuff is kind of following the obvious logical, it's October and therefore spooky season. So lots and lots of the stuff that you didn't mention this month is the sort of more niche-y or semi-niche-y scary type stuff. There's the Goosebumps series. And if you're thinking, wasn't there already a Goosebumps series in the 90s? Yes, there was. This is a new one. Peacock has something called John Carpenter's Suburban Screams, which might be interesting. There are the kind of bunch of international Netflix shows that are kind of in the horror vein that either will attract a little bit of buzz or they won't. That's the fun thing about Netflix is when you look at their top 10, it's always an amusing mixture of strange acquisitions, thoroughly random movies, a couple of the big shows, and then there are always at least two shows in their top 10 that are recent premieres that Netflix just didn't send out to critics. And I'm like, where the hell did that show come from? And, you know, that's great. But there are definitely big titles. I think Loki is probably still a big title. I think that people might not have been hugely enthusiastic about the first season, but I think people liked it. And I think if you look at the reviews for the second season, and I'll talk about it more in Critics Corner this week, I would say that I'm sort of more towards the negative side, and I still found the show very watchable both seasons. So definitely not negative. But there are some big things. Lessons in Chemistry obviously is a big title because it was a, you know, best-selling book that's been towards the top of the bestseller list for a long time. It has Brie Larson, who obviously is an Oscar-winning actress, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll review that next week. It, you know, some of the reviews for it have been generally positive. It, you know, the embargo did go up this week. They're kind of random things that I'm curious about. I think I'm the only person who watched the first season of Wolf Like Me, and I think I will watch the second season because I liked it. It wasn't a great show. It was one of those shows where Peacock made it very hard to talk about because they were strangely resistant to have people say in their reviews that the show involved werewolves, despite the fact that the show is called Wolf Like Me. Guess what? The show involves werewolves. There's no reason not to spoil that. Guess what? I'm also going to spoil Found in the Critics Corner segment. So neener, neener, neener. A lot of there are interesting things, and I think there are interesting things for all sorts of people. I think that Frasier on Paramount Plus is aiming at a different audience from a lot of these shows. Now, as to whether it's actually going to succeed with that audience, I think that probably it's the kind of show where the people who want it to be good have the very real possibility of either being pleased because it is, or of being really disappointed. I should emphasize, I have watched 0 seconds of the new Frasier thus far, so I am not in any way speculating that reviews are going to be positive or negative. I do not know, but I do know that people love the original series in a deep way, and therefore, if it falls short of that, people will have concern. And then there are the shows that are sort of coming towards their end. I believe this is the penultimate season of Big Mouth. I think that there's one more season after this one. I feel like that's what we've said, or other people have said. Anyway, always happy with having new episodes of Big Mouth. I think it probably is a show that has probably gone on a little bit longer than it needed to necessarily, but I still always like watching it. I don't like Upload as much as you do, but I like Upload. I thought the second season, unfortunately, wasn't really all that funny. I thought it was good in some ways, but not all that funny. Also, do you remember where the second season of Upload ended? Like what, like where the story was? I don't have a clue.
I mean, vaguely, but I've also started watching my season 3 screener.
Oh, okay. Not, you're cheating is what you're saying. I have.
There is a previously on Upload.
I hope so. I hope it's like a 5 minute previously on Upload. I was very appreciative, for example, of the God. What was I'm trying to think? There have been several shows lately that I've checked out screeners for that I was very grateful to have additional episodes. If I watch additional episodes of Shining Veil, I am really going to need a reminder of what that first season was. With Loki, I actually rewatched the last couple episodes of the first season because I just did not remember where the show had finally ended up. But yeah, I think there are things. And then there are the prestige-y things. Again, you get to the end of the month, you got Fellow Travelers, which is a gay love story set against a McCarthy-era backdrop. That clearly is a show that Showtime thinks is a prestige-y award-type show. Gilded Age proved not to be a big Emmy player, but I think that probably it's a show that's kind of acquired more of an audience, and some people are curious. And as always, that is a show with as good a cast as there is on TV. And you didn't even mention it, but there's a new season of Shoresy coming to Hulu, darn it, and I'm looking forward to that. So there's stuff. There is stuff to keep you busy in the month of October.
Number 3.
Up next, while we inch back to a return to format with headlines coming back soon, this week we did hear news that one of our favorites, Max's Sort Of, is ending after 3 seasons. And Well, another show that existed, iCarly, is actually not coming back and has been canceled after 3 seasons at Paramount Plus. So with all that in mind, we're kind of taking a moment here to review some of the big cancellations that happened over the past few months that we neglected to discuss because, well, let's be honest, the WGA strike took priority. In a larger sense, these cancellations speak more to the industry-wide contraction that began before Hollywood's labor unrest. So keep in mind, I'm going to rattle through a bunch of shows in a minute, but some of these were tied to the broadcast upfronts back in May. Others happened more recently amid wholesale changes that came as a result of scaled back budgets and new priorities at different platforms. And some were just based on a lack of viewership. So I'm just going to start from the top. So we got Home Economics at ABC, While You Were Breeding at Freeform, which was scrapped and before it even had an opportunity to air. Stars in One Fell Swoop canceled Heels, Run the World, and Blind Spotting, and then announced that The Venery of Samantha Bird, which was halfway through production with Katherine Langford attached to star, was not going to resume production during because of the strike, which is, as we know, a cop-out. Bumper in Berlin, the Pitch Perfect offshoot, is gone at Peacock, despite a previous season 2 renewal. Winning Time kind of just abruptly ended, which I was kind of surprised by that. The Wonder Years at ABC. Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel, which was a staple for decades at HBO. How I Met Your Father at Hulu. The Great, another prestige show, also canceled at Hulu. That was really surprising. File this one under Not a Shocker, The Idol at HBO. Disney Plus scrapped the plans for the Spiderwick Chronicles. They also canceled Doogie Kamehameha. I probably said that wrong. Kamehaloha?
Yes,
King Kamehameha, who is the official person in Hawaii who's like beloved, but Kami Aloha, is the Disney Plus show. Anyway, All Rise at
OWN. You've got 75 more shows to list. Don't get bogged down.
I know. I'm sorry.
In fact, if you want me to start reading some of them, I can.
This is good for me.
I would prefer though if you would sing them to the tune of My Favorite Things. If you could do that, that would make it really much easier for me to digest. Anyway, continue.
Start me off, Dan. I'll hum a few bars. Let me see if I can do it.
Dun 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 dun.
All Rise at OWN, A League of Their Own, The Peripheral, City on Fire. No, this is terrible.
You've never watched.
I don't get paid to sing, Dan. I have, but it's been a long time, my friend. All right, so All Rise is ending at OWN. A League of Their Own was unrenewed. Amazon, The Peripheral was unrenewed at Amazon. City on Fire. Who cares? It doesn't exist anymore. City on Fire at Apple. Disenchantment ended at Netflix. Suspicion gone at Apple. Up Here, the musical comedy at Hulu, is very charming. Great cast, gone. A Black Lady sketch show, gone at HBO. That was, we love Robin Thede on this show, as you know. High Desert at Apple. Single Drunk Female and The Watchful Eye at Freeform. Showtime scrapped Gattaca and Seasoned. Obviously, lots going on at Showtime on the executive front. Lots of changes there. Your beloved show, Reservation Dogs, which we will talk a lot more about in our next segment, that wrapped its run because Sterling Harjo said this was going to be the end. The other two at HBO Max, Breeders at FX, Comedy Central waited years to get Amy Schumer back for the long-awaited 5th season of Inside Amy Schumer and then scrapped it. Grease, Rise of the Pink Ladies, gone after 1. Star Trek Prodigy, that was the animated show focusing on kids, trying to get them to become Trekkies and watch with their parents. It was a big push for Paramount Plus and something Alex Kurtzman wanted to do for a very long time. Unrenewed. The Game, gone at Paramount Plus. High School Musical, The Musical, ended at Disney Plus. American Auto, now we're getting into broadcast. NBC cleared house of a lot of comedies with American Auto, Young Rock, and Grand Crew. The CW continued to gut its previous regime's schedule. Walker Independence, Gotham Knights, RIP. I Love That For You, gone at Showtime. Perry Mason canceled at HBO. The Winchesters at the CW. More broadcast casualties. The Company You Keep. Big Sky. Alaska Daily. Kung Fu. Fantasy Island. True Lies. East New York. Call Me Cat. And possibly the most expensive one on this show, Metropolis at Apple, that had years of development. Universal Cable Productions with Sam Ismail. That was going to be a very big budget show. But gone, Dan. I mean, when you think about it, what we're talking about here, these are millions and millions of dollars that each of these companies said farewell to. And there's various reasons here. You know, some people, you know, put out generic statement that said, oh, because of the timing of the strikes, we're not able to get back into production. And that pushes the show back a year. And we already have a marketing budget carved out. And we couldn't afford to add this then, et cetera. So that was obviously a factor in some of it. But a lot of it, Dan, like I said, it speaks to what's happening in our industry with the industry-wide contraction.
Yeah, there's a lot. there are basically different reasons for almost every single one of these. And that is fun. And some of them are, you know, completely and totally understandable. Some of them are absolutely creative decisions. You know, you did include reservation dogs in this group, but reservation dogs ended basically the way reservation dogs was supposed to end. And you can go back to last week's podcast where Alan Sepinwall and I discussed the final season and the finale, which were both absolutely remarkable. And we, of course, have chronicled extensively what happened with the League of Their Own at Amazon. And that remains infuriating in its own variety of ways, probably two or three different ways, most particularly how it kind of yanked the audience around a little bit, which is,
I mean, Amazon and Sony went back and forth for 6 months to get a reduced licensing fee for 4 episode second and final season, which is a weird sentence to say. All 4 episodes were already written and strike hit, and then now it's gone. Hopefully they'll find a new home. Obviously, you know how I feel about that show.
Indeed. Some of these are shows that obviously didn't find an audience or didn't find a buzz or didn't find whatever. You know, I think the number of people who were conversing about High Desert out in the world, not a particularly large number. It wasn't a bad show. And some of these obviously were extraordinarily expensive shows that made them hard to want to justify. So The Peripheral would be an easy example of a show that just very clearly was not worth it to Amazon at whatever its price was. Presumably
very high. And
yeah,
probably a show that should not have been renewed for a second season, but that's Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan, top producers at Amazon. They have a big 9-figure deal there. And they are also working on the video game adaptation of Fallout, which is going to be a very big priority for them. So that was probably a renewal that was a little political.
And we talked about the sort of behind the scenes stuff that either was or wasn't happening on the other two and whether that stuff had anything to do with why it was canceled. Who knows? Then there are the handful of shows that were only kind of in development. So it's hard necessarily to know if we should be grieving Metropolis, though it seemed conceptually interesting. And Gattaca is another one of those kind of random Showtime adaptation titles. Like, why
it's allegedly Chris McCarthy's favorite movie, and this was the first thing that he bought after gaining oversight of Showtime, only to kill it too.
It's a good movie. It really is. But does that necessarily mean that there was an audience out there for a television show for it right now? I don't know. And then there are a handful of these shows that I feel sad about losing, but I understand that they were probably just the sort of things where they were just kind of too marginal, which is sad. Single Drunk Female was a really good show and was a show that had some important things that it wanted to be about. I'm a little sad that that show couldn't keep going, but if it was sort of a small show that was easy to dismiss, then that's how it goes. I Love That For You would be another show like that. All of the shows on it, all of the comedies that NBC canceled, both Grand Crew and American Auto in particular, just not big enough successes by broadcast standards, however good they were. Wonder Years was a really good show. It just never got the kind of buzz that might have been necessary to be a success. So there are lots of different reasons why various of these shows cease to exist. The one that
is most surprising on this list for me, I mean, obviously everyone knows how I feel about A League of Their Own, so that's gutting for me on a personal level. But on a professional level, The Great on Hulu, that's kind of like a defining hit for Hulu Originals, but it didn't break through with awards. Who knows what the viewership was? And it was probably a very expensive show because doing period shows adds up.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if that show would have gotten a fourth season if it had gotten 10 Emmy nominations third season, I guess, would have been the one that wasn't really on Emmy radars at all. Whereas there were some nominations for it earlier, not as many as it probably deserved. Hard to know how much things like that matter. Like, would Winning Time have gotten more of a leash if the first season had been nominated for 10 Emmys, if it had been kind of more presented?
The Lakers had embraced it?
I think
or
that
the NBA had embraced it?
I think that probably did make a difference. I think the fact that the NBA didn't make it into a big thing, though, I think probably a lot of people in the NBA were probably really enjoying it. They just didn't want to, they didn't want Jerry West to come after them and beat them up or anything. I kid. Jerry West has no anger management problems at all. but yeah, so, and also, again, you mentioned how expensive it is to do period shows. There's no way that Winning Time was a cheap show. That was a, and it showed. That was a show that looked fantastic also. I loved the look of that show. It was
That was an expensive cast too.
Expensive cast, expensive production budget, all of the stuff. That was a great looking show. So, but on the other hand, yeah. So with that one, like the way that it ended, the idea that that was the way that show ended for Winning Time is a disappointment. Yeah. Lots of different reasons for a lot of these. And in a time in which we'd been doing headlines on a weekly basis, probably we would have broken down a lot of these individually, but rest in peace, all of you.
Yeah, and a special shout out to everyone who was affected by these cancellations. And if you found out that your show was canceled while you were on strike, well, I live with someone that that happened to, and it's not an easy process. So sending our love and light to the people who were affected here.
Yeah, these are, that's, we often forget that. And we often forget that when we talk about cancellations on a weekly basis, you know, where it's one show at a time. That list that Leslie just ran through and refused to sing, it does represent thousands of people who lost their jobs. And many of them will obviously move on to other shows, and that's how it goes. But it doesn't change the fact that this represents passion projects, life's work,
blood,
countless,
sweat, and tears.
Yeah, blood, sweat, and tears. And when you see a list in list form like that, it is always important to remember just how many people that impacts.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Number 4.
Up 4th. If you've paid any attention to social media feeds, either mine or The Hollywood Reporter's in recent days, you might have heard that three of THR's finest TV critics slash reporters got together and we all banged our heads together for weeks or months, and we came up with a list of the 50 best shows of the 21st century. It is a great list. It put in thousands upon thousands of words and was tremendously edited by our editor, John Frosch. Our entire art and design team put in an excellent, excellent, excellent stretch of work on it. All just good work. But in terms of actually discussing the list and how it came to be and basically what our biggest fights were, it is a pleasure to welcome friend of the five and multi-time visitor Angie Hahn and longtime listener and also friend of the five Robin Barr here to discuss our remarkable list of the best shows of the 21st century.
Thanks for joining us, everybody.
A pleasure. I don't know. Am I supposed to say it's great to join you, Leslie?
Yes, absolutely, Dan. But Angie, Robin, thank you so much for joining us specifically.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is a dream.
So before we get into what made the list and what didn't, let's start with how you narrowed the field to come up with these 50, because this is not just the best shows of a year, it's the best shows of the past 23 years. So in case you've been living under a rock, we are coming out of a peak TV period where there were 600 scripted originals, English language alone in 2022. So how did you guys narrow this list? Because the qualifications meant that if a show aired some of its seasons after 2000, it was still eligible. So it's even more.
We sort of set the artificial structure of any episodes of any TV show that aired after December 31st, 1999 was eligible, but shows that were straddling both sides of the line were not eligible. Anyway, I talk too much on this podcast as is. Either Angie or Robin, break down how we did this thing.
Well, first there was some talking about the rules. So like what Dan said was one of them. So the shows that, you know, started in the late 90s, but carried through into the 2000s, we only counted as eligible the seasons that aired in the 2000s, which I'm sure I will discuss later, but did end up there were some shows that we loved but that didn't make it for that kind of reason. Then beyond that, it was a lot of just compiling a really, really long collective list of shows that, you know, we thought of that we were like, oh, maybe this one, I don't love the show, but maybe you guys do. Or like, I love the show and I want to talk about it. Or like, this is a really popular show, so we should at least discuss it. And the list was just like hundreds of titles long. And then over a few different Zoom discussions, we started to narrow it down by a combination of voting and simple conversing about it.
Yeah, and when you say hundreds, that's not figurative. We started off with hundreds of shows, and we narrowed the hundreds of shows down to well over 100 plus. Then we narrowed that down to still around about 100. Then we narrowed that down to probably like 80. It really was an extensive process, and a lot of people kind of popping up, what about this, what about that? The truth is, there's almost no chance that there's any show you could mention that we didn't at least touch on. Maybe we didn't necessarily give every show as much attention as some people might have wanted. I can't say on that, but we went through a lot of stuff.
I think the shows that were just over the borderline or could have potentially been in the top 60 but didn't make the top 50 were the ones that we spent probably the most time talking about and debating and kind of reworking and maybe tearing up a little bit about, at least on my part.
And like, yeah, and there were so many different ways that we did this, because we started off, I think initially we kind of graded every show from 0 to 3, which was totally arbitrary way of doing it, but whatever. There was also an extensive period of making sure that everybody had seen or sampled just about every show. So this took place over multiple months. And then the actual narrowing down of the rankings themselves, I believe at some point we each ranked our top 50, and then we kind of saw if there was any way we could make sense of it based on that. And then we debated and yelled at each other and fought. It should be noted, it was actually very, very civil. There was only a limited amount of swearing, I think, relatively speaking. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I kind of swore a little bit when I was reading the list, because my favorite comedy of all time, Friends, didn't make the list. And I think a lot of other people's favorite show, The Office, also didn't make the list, although The Office did get an honorable mention. How? I mean, those are two of the most beloved comedies in the past period, like in the past. Just
so I guess the thing that I would ask you, Leslie, is when were the best seasons of Friends? And were they past the year 2000? Because my guess is probably not.
Well, as much as I love Ross and Rachel, I really did love Rachel and Joey, which is sacrilege, I know, but like that was later in the season, in this show's run, right? The finale is to me a perfect episode of television. I mean, I love the final season. I mean, but I get the bloat, you know, I understand that. But
like, here's how I would put it. I kind of put peak Friends at the one where everybody finds out. That's kind of the episode that I would say is the best. That's the one that always comes to my mind, not necessarily as the best, but kind of as the show at its peak for me. And, you know, then you kind of look and you think, okay, well, if the peak of the show for me was an episode that was in February of 1999, already at that point, it becomes
all right,
virtually impossible to do that. So that would be what I would say is what happened to your beloved Friends. Now, as for The Office, it was just a lot of discussion and a lot of things that, you know, a lot of shows and a lot of the rankings that people quibble about, which, by the way, they should, because everybody loves the television. That's why we do this, is based on, you know, sort of not a cost benefit analysis, but on a scale of the seasons that were awesome, the seasons that were less awesome, and how much we penalize the show for the seasons that are less awesome. And I think in a lot of the cases where people kind of have affection for shows that are all-encompassing rather than on a season-by-season basis, a lot of the reasons why we eliminated certain shows is there were too many seasons that were in the bad bucket versus the good bucket.
Arrested Development being one of them, for sure, because we've certainly gotten a lot of commentary about that one. But I agree with you. I love The Office, and if it ended after season 4, I would say perfect 4 seasons of television, no notes. but it also went through a lot of years of trouble. And trust me, Leslie, I'm with you. Like, giving up Buffy was very hard for me because I'm actually like a seasons 5 through 7 apologist. But ultimately, I had to agree that the seasons in the 90s were much better than the ones in the 2000s. This was hard.
So where were the big disagreements between the three of you about like which shows should be on the list? Like what came close? Where did you argue basically? Because this is a very, very tough job that you all had. And the list is pretty incredible. But I know that you all have very vastly different tastes. So where were the big shockers for you individually about things that you really wanted to get on there but couldn't, or the disagreements?
You can throw us under the bus on our biggest fight / debate if you want to, Robin. It's fine.
No, I'm laughing because I was definitely the stickler. I would say Dan and I are the most like feelingsy. Angie for sure is the most like logical one of us. And so where we disagreed, it was a lot of me and Dan being like extra about our passions. The thing that I think definitely caused the most pathos was not including My Brilliant Friend. And the reason we didn't include it was because there was some debate on how we evaluate international television or television that's in languages other than English. And it was ultimately determined that we could not evaluate the vast breadth of shows that are not available to American audiences typically. So we chose English language television to, you know, honor the fact that most TV available to our audiences is in English. And so, you know, that hurt me because I love My Brilliant Friend so much. I think it's one of the best TV shows ever created. But ultimately, we had to go by the parameters that we set.
I would say that was our most hated, our most heated debate. Probably hated one of the
that
other.
That was the biggest sticking point, I think, when we were making the list. And you know, it's like I concur, like I stand by the decision, but it was painful to have to eliminate some stuff because of that, including, of course, Robin's most beloved, My Brilliant Friend. But you know, it did get a mention in the intro, which everyone should read before they comment on how they're mad at us about our picks, because a lot of the comments we're getting are like, why wasn't this included? It's like, Dan explained in the intro why that didn't qualify. So
excuse me, Dan didn't explain anything. There are no bylines on any part of this this article. This is a collective thing by the three of us. The intro explains. Does that feel like your role, though, Angie, as Robin just described it? Like, did you feel like you were playing mediator between us?
I didn't feel like it, actually. And I was surprised when Robin said that I was the most logical, just because I had not really thought of it in those terms. But I mean, I do think that we had a pretty good balance of, you know, like Robin and Dan have fairly different tastes a lot of the time. Which made for some really lively and fun conversations and maybe brought up things that, like, you know, like if someone really is really passionate about something and the other person isn't, it brings up some ideas that we may not otherwise have had or anything like that. And I think we also just tried to keep in perspective, like, yes, we want to take really seriously this task and, you know that we're doing it with the authority of our own voices as critics and also with THR and whatnot. But we also are very aware of the fact that, like, there is no such thing as just like a be all end all definitive list of the best TV. Like, even for us, I think, like, probably all of us would say if we had to remake this list today, like, a lot of those things might be moved around. Maybe different things would make it on or off or things like that. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of I think my favorite comment I've seen on it was something along the lines of, like, you know, this list is obviously wrong, but it's a great list of like shows that I haven't seen yet that I want to check out now. And I was like, that's exactly what I really want people to use it for. Like, you know, I don't necessarily expect people to look at this list and agree. We knew going in, obviously, people are always going to say, well, what about this show? What about this show? This show's ranked too high. This show's ranked too low. But if it's a show that's introducing people to great TV, if it's a show that allows people to celebrate the shows that are on there, if it's a list that allows people to celebrate the shows that are on there, I feel like we've done our job in a great way.
Yeah, that's my favorite comment as well, honestly, because on this list, 98% of the shows on this list are honestly shows that I love to varying degrees. So if you want to disagree about the placement, or if you want to love shows that aren't on the list, awesome. But like, if you haven't watched the shows on this list, these are some great television shows.
Robin, we know the show that it hurt you to leave off Angie, what was the one that you really pushed hard, but it didn't make it on the list?
The one I wanted to put on that actually got cut for the same reason was Los Espookies. I was a really big fan of that show. I thought it was so unique and unusual and whatnot. And we went around for a bit because I think with that one, like, I can see an argument for, like, it is an American show, even if it is primarily in Spanish and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it seemed like just kind of too nitpicky, an exception to carve out and to have to explain and all that. So we left it out. I'm very sad about that. But, you know, it's a show that I hope people will find and watch regardless of whether it is on this list and that I will talk about otherwise.
What about you, Dan? What's the one that got away?
They're the sort of more esoteric documentary type things that I love that I'm not sure are as well represented, whether it's the absence of anything Ken Burns-y. I think U.S. and the Holocaust would have been a good thing to have on here. I think that America to Me, which was my number one show of 4 years ago, 5 years ago, who understands time anymore? Whatever year it came out, Stars as America to Me was my number one show of that year. I would have loved to have had a place for it somewhere on the list. A few things like that. There are a lot of shows that I love, like truly love, that didn't make this list. But for the most part, I'm reasonably okay with that, I think. What else slipped through the cracks for you, Robin, other than My Brilliant Friend? Because I should add also, I love My Brilliant Friend. It would have been in my top 25 without any question at all. So yeah, that's another one for me, sure.
I mean, I think I've had some friends reach out saying, like, oh, you know, why wasn't Louie on this, or why wasn't this or that? And I'm thinking, like, well, if this was Robin Barr's top 50, this list would have had way more Britcoms on it, way more probably obscure shows that probably I only watched. So I think we did a very good job at finding equilibrium between us and also honoring everyone's top choices, even if they weren't exactly like what the other two people, you know, were totally in love with. We kind of were able to balance that via rankings. And I think that became sort of the way that we could find, not equitability exactly, I don't know if that's exactly the word, but honor the fact that there are three people doing this, and there's no hierarchy of like who gets, you know, the most voting power or not. And that was one of the most fun aspects of it too. And it was also really fun to be able to kind of learn about each other through our taste, if that makes any sense.
By fighting, absolutely.
There wasn't that much fighting. There was impassioned debate.
Absolutely. No, it was really reasonably civil, but it was still, there were multiple Zoom conversations that went over 3 hours towards the end. There were definitely multiple 3 hour plus Zooms as we got to the actual top 50 or 60, and then we moved things around. Some of those Zooms went on for a long time.
So how did you determine the top 10? Like, did you each have votes, or like, talk me through it? And then we'll get into, you know, maybe this is the same question, but how did you eventually crown Mad Men number one?
From what I remember, we started by kind of like, there were some shows that, like, you know, we each made our own top 50 lists. And then there were some shows that were like hovering near the top of all of ours. So like, it was like, you know, in some cases it was very easy to be like, I think Mad Men was one that all three of us had like ranked super highly. So it was like very easy to just like be like, clearly this is going to be, you know, top three, top five or something like that, just based on how much each of us seems to like it and things like that. So I think we started by kind of just vaguely putting things in like areas, like we were like, this feels like it would be in the middle of the list. This feels like maybe it's toward the bottom. This feels like it's maybe toward the top. And so we did that. And then we went through and kind of fine tuned it depending on, you know, just, and that was more of a gut instinct thing. Like there wasn't like math involved for that part. It was just the three of us like looking at the list together and staring at it and kind of saying like, you know, what, like asking each other, like, what does your gut say about like this show that we have currently slotted at number 15 versus the one we have at number 16, like, you know, things like that. So I think from what I remember, the top few were actually the easiest. And then after that, it was really hard to fill 5 through 10, because I think all of us were a little shy about trying to figure out like, you know, we know what maybe our top 3, 4, 5 are, but like, what deserves to be like number 6? What deserves to sit right under there? For me, at least, that was one of the harder parts. But, you know, at some point, everything has to slot in.
Yeah, from what I remember, the top three were like the easiest, and maybe the things that we chose at the very the first thing that we did. Like, and it wasn't really even hard to rank them. It was just what whatever our heart was telling us, it was telling us in kind of tandem with each other.
Yeah. And just to clarify, number one is Mad Men. Number two, The Sopranos. Number three, Succession. Number four, 30 Rock. Number five, The Wire. Number six, Reservation Dogs. Number seven, Better Call Saul. Number eight, Girls. Number nine, Freaks and Geeks. And number 10, BoJack Horseman. You can read the rest of the list at THR.com. But since we are talking about the top 10, it made sense to list them now.
So. Oh, absolutely. And we don't necessarily need to go through them to explain how they got there. But yeah, no, once we all made our own top 50, I think it really was kind of obvious the shows that were in, you know, all of our top fives. Not surprisingly, those are the shows that are at the very top. I think that probably something like, you know, and obviously, you know, you pay attention to, you interact with people who've been reading it, and there are sort of conversations about recency bias. And I think that that's why the introduction, that definitely wasn't written by any one of us, emphasized that this is a living list. This is not necessarily the list that this would be in 6 months or a year or 5 years or whatever. I think conversationally, there was some trepidation about Reservation Dogs, just because as we were making the list, it still had five episodes left to go this season. And I definitely was watching for the past couple of weeks of the series, basically going, okay, is something really horrible and dramatic going to happen that's going to cause me to go, oh shit, now we need to move Reservation Dogs by 15 places. And it didn't. And that's a wonderful tribute to Reservation Dogs, is that I feel like it actually is in exactly the right place and possibly even deserves to be bumped up one or two places, possibly.
Stuck the landing.
Completely. And I think we had worries that if it didn't, we might need to do some shuffling. But I think it's where it belongs. So yay, Reservation Dogs.
Yeah, I think if anything, the thing I remember being the most painful was when we had cut the list down to like 52 or something. And then there was just so much conversation about like, we clearly love all 52 shows, but we need to cut two of them. And which one is it going to be? And that was a thing that took up a lot of time. And it was very sad and stressful, because if they made it that far, it means we all really respect and love the hell out of them.
And we also, when we were doing the ratings, at some point we ended up with like 30 shows between number 25 and 35. That was also a strange thing where we're like, well, this isn't necessarily a top 10 show, but we feel like it's too good to be a bottom 10 show. But again, bottom 10 on this list are 10 fantastic shows that if you haven't seen, you should watch all of them. I don't mean by any stretch of the imagination to say that a show like, I don't know, that like Vita or, you know, what else was in the quote unquote bottom 10, Southside, Hell,
Insecure,
yeah. The Crown, Leftovers. Those are fantastic shows. So there's no bottom 10 here. This is not like we ranked Work It, Mixology, and Mario Lopez's Hater here. Those would be the shows that would be in our bottom 10 of the last 23 years. There's no bottom 10 here, but definitely we ended up stuck with a bunch of shows between 25 and 35 where we weren't quite prepared to put them in the top 10, and we weren't quite prepared to put them 40 to 50, and then we had to. Honestly, it's just sort of moving, it's shuffling things around on a board. But if you happen to be obsessive, And I think there's probably some
And we are, Dan.
And I think we all have some obsessive streak to us. Oh, it yeah. came into play.
Yeah.
But so, okay. I was just going to say, I remember like the moment where it was like, fuck it, we have to cut the Up documentary series, because I had been a stickler on that one. And ultimately it was like, well, the show did start in the 60s. So even though I do think the best episodes are in the 2000s, it's like at some point you just have to make a sacrifice. So we got some sort of question marks about that one, but I will absolutely die on the hill that the best episode was the one that came out like a few years ago. So
I think most
we
of
got
it,
some what's up, like what is it, because it's not a very Googleable name, because it started before SEO considerations were a thing.
And yeah, so a lot of people had to have that explained to them, which is entirely fair, because also no one refers to any one of the movies as Up. So you have to know it's the series that starts with 7 Up and goes through all of them, the Michael Apted documentary series, etc. You have to explain that, which you can't necessarily explain if you just write down Up. But that's what it is. It's fantastic. Everyone should watch that one too.
All right. So number one, Mad Men. How much of a debate was there?
I feel like we Almost all kind of looked. Yeah, I feel like we looked at where the numbers were and we said, yeah, that seems right.
So it was an easy decision.
Ironically, that I think figuring out what was going to be number one was actually way easier than figuring out what was going to be like number 15.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that Mad Men was all three of our number ones or necessarily any of our number ones. But I think that sort of in the balance, as democracy took hold here, we looked at what the situation was and where our votes were, and it seemed right. I don't know any other way to put it. As we looked at the list and we said, yeah, that seems roughly what this list's number one is supposed to be.
Well, that's actually everything that I have about this list. Is there anything else y'all wanted to add? I mean, I can just talk about how grateful I am that Freaks and Geeks and Friday Night Lights, two of my favorite dramas, made the list.
I feel like they're weirdly good companion pieces for each other, too, because they're both like really good high school dramas, but like from opposite social circles.
And we never had to deal with which of the freaks or which of the geeks would commit violent murder in the premiere of Freaks and Geeks season two. So we never had to watch the show dig out of that particular hole.
The Landry kill the guy thing came up multiple times. I think like Dan brought up like every Zoom call that we had about this project.
Well, but ultimately, the series as a whole is better, even though that season was especially terrible.
Well, it's sort of the answer to how many bad seasons you're entitled to in order to make the list. Is you're entitled to one Friday Night Lights season two in the case of Arrested Development. You're not entitled to two Netflix seasons. That's kind of where the math is. And I think there are several of the shows that are on this list or in the honorable mention list where they had a bad season here and there, because everyone's entitled to a bad season. And, you know, I should add, going with the kind of the one of the things that people have mentioned or complained about, I'm surprised you didn't, Leslie, that there is an obvious disadvantage in our methodology, but also in the way that critics watch television, to broadcast shows. And so part of why a show like The Office does get penalized, unquestionably, is that it existed on a network that said, please give me more The Office because you're doing well. Here, do as many episodes as you want. Here, last several years after Steve Carell left, even if you're not necessarily the same show. It hurts a show like that, whereas a show like Fleabag, I mean, it did two seasons and they were fantastic and they were six episodes apiece, but they were, you know, that's 6 hours of television compared to hundreds of hours of television in some of these cases. And did we penalize a lot of broadcast shows for going on too long or for having too many bad seasons or episodes? And could, in a different world, you step back and also simultaneously give them bonus points for doing that and for being impressed with how many great episodes there were of The Office, even if there were also awful episodes of The Office? Yeah, I think that's a totally worthy alternative perspective on the process. Is we could have said, okay, on one hand, we're penalizing some of these shows for going on too long, but on the other hand, we also want to give them credit for the quote unquote adversity of working in broadcast. But we
right. I mean, no, This Is Us, and then in terms of other recent breakouts, nothing here for Ted Lasso, nothing for Schitt's Creek. A little surprising.
I think everybody just made a face at Ted Lasso.
I think there are a lot of shows out there that are good. And I don't think there's any shame to being a good show. And I don't think there's any shame to being a good broadcast show. It's just that was not what we were doing this list on. I don't know what other things have Angie and Robin, what else have you guys been hearing on social media about things that are missing, things that are egregiously, I mean, other than the inevitability of Girls being kind of the representative show that everybody wants to complain is too high, except for the people who are like, no, it's probably exactly where it's supposed to be. But definitely a lot of people in my mentions going, how can you have Girls higher than Breaking Bad or something? But what have you guys heard?
I've heard Lost, some complaints about, Lost. And some people have been talking about The Good Wife, which I was definitely a proponent of The Good Wife, but, things happen.
Lost, The Good Wife, West Wing, although people don't necessarily seem to disagree that Like, not everyone is, like, mad that it's not on the list. They're all just, like, it's more people being like, huh, I remember when this show, like, would have seemed like a shoo-in for something like this, and clearly it no longer is. So it's, yeah, that part of it's been kind of interesting.
Yeah, and Good Wife, obviously, I think, ooh, you got, and she's got a good one.
Oh, no, and I was going to move on to say, and the flip side is that then I've also seen people really excited about some of the things that we included that were not necessarily shows that would be obvious for a list like this. Like, I've seen, like, at least the people I've talked to or have seen comments on it seemed thrilled to see, like, Vita on there, which is, like, a relatively small show compared to some of the really, really big shows that we had on this list.
Yeah, and something like The Good Wife, I think probably it got a little bit, not hosed or screwed, but it got a little bit diffused by The Good Fight, because when it came down to one of those last one or two spaces, Robin was like, we should have The Good Wife on the list, and I was like, but no, we should have The Good Fight on the list instead. And that then became Paralysis, and they both got left out. And that was just how it went. You know, that if a show split into two, and if the two versions were as discernibly different as they are, and one person wanted to celebrate one and the other person wanted to celebrate the other, instead they ended up with either one. So that happened in a couple cases, I would say. Yeah, Lost has gotten a few, and I think there it becomes a question of whether the list was supposed to be a most influential list. I think if it was an influential top 50, Lost is a guarantee to be there. But, you know, instead it isn't. A couple people have mentioned Louie. I think, as I've told several of those people, we have at least five shows on the list that I am certain would not exist without Louie.
Exactly.
And so to me, that kind of represents them. Like, you would not have Atlanta without Louie. You would not have Better Things without Louie. You would not have Reservation Dogs without Louie. This is unquestionably a true thing. And so here we are acknowledging you would not have these shows without Louie. And we have those shows on the list.
And we certainly discussed Louie, which was a very memorable show for me. But I agree with you, Dan. And when I've been talking to people, they're, you know, at least privately, they're like, well, you didn't choose him because he got canceled. And, like, you know, that's actually not related to our discussion, because I'm one of those people that's very good at separating the art and the artist. And ultimately, for me, it came down to the progeny of Louie, you know, these tonal anthologies that have really thrived on FX, to me, stand out more than the original, which can sometimes be alienating in the way that I think the storytelling was maybe nonlinear or a little bit obfuscating. Like, is it great TV? Yes, but I don't think it is set in my cultural memory as much as some of its progenitors.
Anyway, it's a great list. We love it. If you haven't watched the shows on the list, seriously, watch them. They're really good.
Well, Angie, Robin, thank you guys so much for joining us this week.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Number five.
As usual, we wrap things up with the Critics Corner. Among this week's major new launches, you've got season 2 of Loki and Our Flag Means Death. Those are Disney Plus and Max, respectively. TBS's Chad returns on its new home at Roku. And Dan, I have no idea what else. That's what the highlights were for me when I looked at the premiere schedules. But you probably have a lot of other things.
Hey, you left out a few things that are highlights. You left out a few things that aren't highlights. You left out a few things from earlier in the week. You left out at least one documentary. There's a lot of stuff. It's just kind of motley stuff. You know, we talked about October, seems like 18 years ago, but it was 5 minutes ago on this podcast, maybe an hour ago, whatever. We did. We talked about October, I promise. If you sort of go with the idea that that television is supposed to be providing something for everybody, I think that this week probably has a little bit of something for everybody. I think next week's podcast is going to have a couple of potentially kind of big ticket reviews that people are looking forward to. I think that next week I will definitely talk about Fall of the House of Usher. Next week I will definitely talk about, actually I could probably talk about Fall of the House of Usher this week, since it does premiere, I think, next Thursday, but maybe it's better to do a full review of it next week, since there's plenty of stuff this week. But anyway, I will also talk about Lessons in Chemistry next week. I will talk about Frasier next week. Lots and lots of stuff to talk about. One of the things you left out that I mentioned that I was going to talk about in in Critics Corner, and that I mentioned I was going to spoil, is Found on NBC. I'm going to spoil it mostly because NBC is spoiling it, but also it's kind of what the show is. And so either you're going to care deeply, in which case you probably watched the show, or you can skip ahead 2 to 3 minutes and that's fine. But anyway, Found is created by Nikeshi Okoro-Carroll, who was a great guest on the podcast. I will let Leslie go back and find her episode where she talked about the All-American spinoff. Where is it? Leslie?
Yeah, and Kay joined us in episode 156 from February 18th, 2022. One of my favorite people in the industry. She's so great. Oh, fabulous interview.
Fantastic. She was great. Also, fellow Penn alum, et cetera, et cetera. I feel like we might have been the same graduating class, maybe separated by a year. Anyway, doesn't matter. And, you know, I think you can tell that there are smart aspects of Found, but I think you can also tell that it's trying to be two things at once. And unfortunately, in the process, it doesn't end up being either of them all that well. In some cases, kind of ridiculously, not necessarily ridiculously badly. One of the things that I emphasized in my review is that Found is significantly better than Alert Missing Persons Unit or whatever the Scott Kahn Fox show is, which is basically the same show. It's kind of a show that is half weekly missing persons procedural and half a serialized plot line to kind of give a cable-y type feel, but at the same time, one that kind of undermines the rest of the show with its ridiculousness. NBC has been promoting this exhaustively, the actual spoiler, but the premise of the show, and I'm about to spoil it, it premiered a few days ago, and it is what it is that you have Shanola Hampton from Shameless as the leader of a non-law enforcement affiliated missing persons rescue squad, and her team is made up entirely of people who have deep personal investments in finding missing people. And there is the undercurrent, not really undercurrent, the pilot, it's pretty much straightforward, the current, that they're investigating the cases that law enforcement too often overlooks. And so in the case of the first episode, that is wondering why, for example, missing persons cases involving missing white children are presented to the media and are solved in a very different way from missing persons cases involving children and people of color. It is, you know, this is a phenomenon. It is a phenomenon that has been the subject of documentaries. It is the subject of the first episode. It's not really what the show is, unfortunately. Like, multiple episodes don't really use that as their basis. Some of them do. There's an episode about the fact that it's very difficult for the police to either solve or to care about solving cases involving undocumented workers. I think that that is also a provocative and important thing. But at the same time, the main character, the Shanola Hampton character, was held hostage for a year by a very strange psychopath played by one of Leslie's favorite people, Mark Paul Gosselaar of the late and lamented Pitch.
Rest MPG.
and he's good. He kind of gives one of those. I compared it to all of the various episodes of Criminal Minds where they get your favorite nice guy actor from your childhood and let them play a serial killer for a week, except it's elongated. And the entire premise of the show, and this is how NBC has been advertising it, is that she was held hostage by this guy for a year. And now, 20 years later, she's got him in her basement in a wooden cage. And she's basically using him as either Hannibal Lecter or as sociopath Google, where anytime she has questions, she goes down and asks him and he gets into the mind of an abductor. My feeling is that probably this is the kind of thing that actually is going to cause people to watch it. So I don't feel bad about spoiling it because I assume some people think that sounds cool. Some people probably think this sounds a little bit like Prodigal Son, which aired on Fox for a couple years and was also executive produced by Greg Berlanti. This is a structure that very clearly he responds to. And again, very clearly, lots of people respond to it. The Silence of the Lamb thing is really what this borrows from more than anything. The first episode very specifically deals with the missing child of a senator. So that's a lot of Silence of the Lamb right there. The second episode boils down to, if I had to summarize it, it would be, what do we covet? We covet the thing we see every day, which is one of the most scary and unsettling scenes in Silence of the Lambs. A lot of ripping off from Silence of the Lambs that's going on here. To me, that plot line is so ridiculous and so strained from reality that it makes it implausible that the show could be touching on things as real as, why don't the police solve cases involving missing black girls as fast as cases involving missing white girls? It undermines the substantive theme of the show. And so that's a little disappointing. You know, a lot of the team here is decent. I think Kelly Williams is very good. She plays a woman whose son was abducted. And I think Shanola Hampton's really great, actually. I think she is an actress who is very capable of handling ridiculous things solidly. Like, a lot of what they made her do for years on Shameless, she had a lot of that show's more ludicrous subplots, and she always handled them fairly well. And so she's a good anchor here. I've seen 5 episodes and I'm probably out. Maybe your enthusiasm will be higher. Totally fine. Loki has already premiered, returned for its second season. The best summary I can give at this point is that it's kind of confirmed its place as being Disney Plus and Marvel saying, wouldn't it be fun to make a Doctor Who season with Tom Hiddleston as the Doctor? And maybe we'll just still call him Loki and that'll be fine. Like, in terms of what the season and what the show at this point have to do with Loki as the character who we met in the MCU, it's almost nothing. Like, it's both basically Tom Hiddleston doing fun Tom Hiddleston-y things and Owen Wilson being kind of dry and wry and homespun and wise. Amazing production design. Like, what I will say about this show more than anything is, it's a show that looks great and has a really good piece of world building. Now, do I specifically care about any of the time travel things happening? I don't know that I really do. And I don't know that it's necessarily as fun as it probably should be at this point. I wish it were significantly more generally entertaining. I wish I were more invested in any of the time travel stuff, the bigger mythological stuff. In honest truth, it's become somewhat more distracting because of Jonathan Majors and the various off-camera stuff that maybe makes it harder to enjoy his performance, or not even necessarily that, simply makes his presence slightly distracting at a point in the show where it doesn't necessarily benefit from being slightly distracting. What I will say is, again, fantastic production design. I also very much like what they've done with the character of Miss Minutes. That would be the talking animated clock. It is actually very funny that that character has become the character with the most arc in the entire series. She is not featured in the first couple of episodes, but once she does show up, she becomes a lot of fun. And so much credit to Tara Strong, who does the voice for her. On the other side, though, Sophia DiMartino, who played Sylvie, one of the Loki variants in the first season, and one of my favorite parts of the first season, really has been that character has just been lost entirely. And so while she absolutely appears, none of the things that I liked about that character are really relevant. So, oh well. Anyway, though, lots of things still to enjoy about Loki. Definitely, though, I did not invest heavily in the new episodes. I invested spottily. So be aware. Our Flag Means Death is a show that is, of course, on Max. And I caught up on the first season in recent weeks, in part because it's a show that people, that some people really do love. Some people thought that the relationship that developed in the first season between Rhys Darby's Steed Bonnet and Taika Waititi's Blackbird was just a really special relationship. And I probably agree. I definitely agree. It's a different relationship. And it is an interesting show in that it brings these LGBTQ plus storylines into the world of a swashbuckling pirate comedy. And so that's an interesting choice. Without any question, the show became better when it became about the relationship between those two characters. So when I talked about it in the first season, I'd only watched a few episodes, and they were episodes before Blackbeard showed up or after he had just showed up. The show gets better in the second half of the season, and I liked the 6 episodes of the new season that I watched. I would say more than the first season. I think it is a show that's surer in its rhythms. It's a show that's sure, especially in its supporting cast, because it's a big ensemble and you have to catch up with some of these characters and kind of be reminded of who they are and what their voices are. I think it does that well. And I feel like the second season has a lot more real pirates. So if you're a fan of the pirate swashbuckling world and you're like, ooh, I know who Ned Lowe is, I think that's sort of one of the fun things about the second season. Is I feel like there's more of that. There are some very good cameos. Second straight week praising a show with a guest appearance by Minnie Driver. The world needs to give Minnie Driver more things to do. She's fantastic, and she's great in the one episode she has here.
R.I.P. So. Speechless.
Oh God, R.I.P. Speechless. Seriously, and we didn't even mention it. We talked about Modern Family and it not making the top 50. The ABC Family show that I tried making, not ABC Family in the freeform sense, the family show that was on ABC that I tried making a case for in the deliberations and it just didn't make it, was Speechless. I think that is a show that, unlike so many of those ABC comedies, that really did kind of get a chance to, if not play out their full string, to kind of have something resembling a life that they were supposed to have. I think Speechless is one, unfortunately, the few that really just didn't. It was one that deserved better. So anyway, Our Flag Means Death. I enjoy it. Some people like it a lot more than I do, but I think it's a really solid show. 2 more things to talk about here, and then I will stop talking because I'm losing my voice and no one needs me to talk more. Bargain on Paramount Plus, which is, I would say, probably the closest to a next Squid Game that we've had since the premiere of Squid Game. For whatever reason, there hasn't been a rush of streamers picking up crazy ass Korean shows and saying, here, if you like Squid Game, you'll like this. Netflix hasn't really done it at all. I think this is one where the comparison actually makes a fair amount of sense. It's sort of half action thriller, half dark satire in that same way that Squid Game is. It is absolutely a show in which the real theme is rich people do horrible things to poor people, and here is the consequence if you put it into a heightened genre context. And the premise of the show basically is, at a remote hotel somewhere out in the Korean countryside, somewhere, it's unspecified, a man shows up in a hotel room. He's paid $1,000 to take the virginity of a young woman who he thinks is an 18-year-old high school junior. It turns out that she is actually part of an organ harvesting network. And he is soon strapped to a gurney, and his organs are being sold to wealthy people, to the highest bidder. And then a gigantic earthquake basically buries the hotel in rubble, and these unlikely people have to align or attempt to kill each other in effort to escape. And so that's a lot of genre elements in a very short period of time. It is directed and written by Jian Woo-sung, and the formal conceit is that every episode is shot to look like a single take or a single shot. And there are absolutely, you know, if you are the kind of person who can spot a masked cut, and I feel like we've been trained to, you'll be able to spot them. It's not relevant. But sometimes it does a terrific job of building up claustrophobia and tension. The production design of the hotel is a marvel. And so there's a lot of winding hallways, and there's one fantastic hole in the center of one of the floors that goes through all of the levels. And so it's a spectacular set centerpiece. And it's violent. It's crazy. It keeps amping up the tension. And I think on a purely technical level, it is often fairly remarkable. You don't want to think too much about it because a lot of it doesn't make sense. And a lot of the characters are very, very thin. But I think if you're the sort of person who says, I like watching a particular version of directorial ethos, I think there's a lot of directing going on here. And I think that it makes it for a pretty exciting run. And that's a Bargain on Paramount Plus. And then last but not least, Last Stop Larima, premieres on Sunday on HBO. It is a feature-length documentary about a missing persons case. That is the theme of this week in very, very rural Australia. And it has elements of Tiger King. It has elements of The Jinx. It's mostly a lot of quirky small town people talking about their grudges. And the cast of characters is an excellent cast of characters. The setting is a very different setting. Some of how it tells the story to me became a little bit convoluted and cumbersome, but I liked Last Stop Larima a pretty fair amount. I think it doesn't overstay its welcome. Again, it's only 2 hours. I can easily imagine how somebody would have thought, ooh, let's try getting 8 hours out of this. They don't. Yeah. So breaking things down quickly, I already spoiled Found for you, and I don't think it's very good, but it's got things about it, and it wouldn't surprise me if it was successful. Like I said, it's better than Alert Missing Persons Unit, and that got renewed for a second season. So there you go. It's also one of the very few broadcast shows on at this moment. So bonus. Loki, you're going to watch Loki anyway if you want to. I didn't fully buy all of this season's timey-wimey stuff. Maybe you'll buy it more. Our Flag Means Death on Max. If you liked the first season, I think it probably gets better in the second season. If you didn't, it's worth checking out. I think if you want to check it out and you didn't, definitely give it 4 or 5 or 6 episodes just to find where the narrative is. And then I really liked Bargain on Paramount Plus. Great piece of directing, really solid thriller, little bit ridiculous, but in an entertaining way. And Last Stop Larima on HBO. It's good. It's 2 hours, and that is enough talking.
For more of Dan's...
No, week- no more!
Well, you're stuck with it. For more of Dan's weekly recommendations, be sure to subscribe to The Hollywood Reporter's Now See This newsletter and bookmark thr.com/TV-reviews for more. This feels like a great place to wrap things up. Thank you, as always, for listening to TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast.
Be sure to subscribe on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. They help spread the word of mouth. Come say hi to us on social media. She's almost always at Snoodit with 2 O's. I'm almost always at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Come say hi. Let us know what's working, what isn't working. If you have questions for future mailbag segments, we already said it, I think, at least 2 or 3 times earlier, but I'm going to say it again. Email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That's tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.